I'm here with George Packer. George, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Sam.
Great to see you. I'm a huge fan of your work. I'm an avid reader of everything you write in The Atlantic. I'm also now a reader of your latest novel, which is titled The Emergency, which I haven't yet finished. I actually wasn't planning to talk about it, but I can just say that it's extraordinarily good and alarming. You've done something very Orwellian, and it's just a very unnerving fable you have written here that I'm deep into, and it really grabbed me from the first page. So I encourage people to read it, whether we talk about it or not. You're a very talented writer, both in fiction and nonfiction. So congratulations.
Thank you, Sam.
Yeah. It's actually beautifully published. FSG still produces a nice book. I love the cover.
And even the texture of it. Yeah. It's special.
Yeah. It's got a very good hand feel, which in these dark digital times, I take more and more pleasure in now. There was a time where I was reading at least half of what I was reading on Kindle and or an iPad, but that's behind me now. I still listen to audio, but now I really love to get back to physical books and hardcovers especially.
I'm with you on that. When I find myself reading too much on the screen, on my phone, I just feel alienated from the words and the world. And when I reach on my shelf for a physical book, there's something solid and reassuring about it. And we must never let them disappear from the world.
Yeah. I don't know if you're so wayward that you've had this experience, but I find that with audio or digital books, because you really never see the cover again, it's possible for me to read a book and even enjoy it and to forget the author's name, right? Because I'm literally never confronted by it again for the whole experience of interacting with the book. As a writer of books, that makes me fairly nauseous.
It's unnerving. Someone wrote it in that the book is the expression of their individuality, their humanity. So we got to keep their name in mind if it's a decent book. Yeah.
Okay. Well, so I mostly want to focus on the article you wrote that was titled America's Zombie Democracy, which came out at, I guess, the end of September, wherein you really just come right out and say that you think we're living in an authoritarian state. And you argue that our expectations about what it would mean to slide into authoritarianism are kind of faulty based on some 20th century examples. And then in the 21st century, the erosion of democratic norms has a different character than, you know, goose-stepping troops in the streets or, people getting, put up against the wall and shot, et cetera. So I guess to start, what in your view are the clearest indicators that we have slid into something like authoritarianism in the U.S. at this point?
Well, one of them came the day the piece was published or the day after, which was the Justice Department filing charges against James Comey and filing them in the most nakedly political way possible after a series of prosecutors had refused. And a grand jury had originally refused to as well. And finally, President Trump found the prosecutor who would do his bidding. And she, in a kind of shambolic way, assembled a case very quickly and got a grand jury to go along with it. And since then, other enemies of the president, political enemies, have also been indicted. And that the rule of law is such a powerful tool, and the pressure of the state weighing down on an individual is so crushing that it almost doesn't matter. Of course, it matters, but they will suffer irrevocably whether or not they're convicted because of the amount of time and money and energy and just sheer anxiety and stress that is involved in having the federal government coming after you. So if the president can do that, can use the Justice Department as his personal police force, prosecution force, to go after people he regards as his political enemies, that's a huge check against unaccountable power that's been taken down. And there are a whole bunch of others, but that one was so glaring that when it happened right away after the article came out, it was as if the White House was saying, we don't care. Yeah, this is what we're doing. Make us stop.
Now, of course, the MAGA retort to that would be, no figure has been more victimized by purely political prosecution than President Trump himself. And that happened under Joe Biden's watch. So by the same measure, they would say, okay, well then authoritarianism arrived during the Biden administration.
Right. And that would make a little bit of sense when it came to the one conviction that for 34 felonies that befell Trump under the Manhattan DA. That was the weakest case against him, and it was the only one that was successful. The others never happened. They fell apart along the way for mainly political reasons. And if you think about how long it took Merrick Garland to name a special prosecutor who then had to begin assembling a case on about January 6th, which was a pretty strong case against the president, the former president. And the fact that it never came to fruition before Trump was reelected, that tells you the rule of law and procedures and norms were in place, or else they would have nailed him long before he was reelected. They would have made sure that Trump was in at least convicted, if not in prison, for attempting to overturn a Democratic election before he became president again. Now it's all history because he's back in power. So I would say there's always some gray area where you can point and say you did it first. But look at the details of that gray area and you see it's not Biden ordering it to be done. It's not Biden going through a series of prosecutors until he can find one who will do it.
Yeah.
It's not a complete rookie prosecutor filing the charges. So it falls apart upon on close inspection, I think.
So in the title of your piece, you have this phrase, zombie democracy, which is referring to the institutions that are persisting in some kind of zombie afterlife. Which institutions are you most worried about at this point? And which are the most crucial in their failure to check Trump and MAGA's authoritarianism?
Let's name two or three. The rule of law, the Justice Department, the justice system is the first. After Watergate, presidents, without having it written down as a law, respected, at least to varying degrees, the independence of the Justice Department, the need to insulate the credible power of prosecution from the White House, from politics. That has completely disintegrated. There is no distinction any longer between what Trump wants and what his attorney general is willing to do. Second, Congress. Congress has stopped functioning as Congress, and that happened before the shutdown ever came along. They no longer assert their right to tax and spend. Trump can tax with tariffs. Trump can spend or not spend if it's been appropriated and he decides he doesn't like it. Trump can eliminate programs that Congress legislated, beginning with USAID. So because of the nature of our partisans' politics, and this has been happening for a long time, again, you could say the Democratic Party became more and more a tool of Democratic presidents, and the Democratic Congress was more willing to cede Article I power to the president if it was a Democratic president. Yes, we've been watching presidents gain more and more power over the last decades, but again, this is a complete qualitative break as the Republican Congress simply cedes its constitutional authorities to the White House without a peep. We're finally seeing a little bit of a break, a little daylight over the Epstein files. Mm-hmm. Seems to be the very first matter in which Republicans in Congress are not lining up in a single file behind Trump. And the third would be the Defense Department, now called the War Department, not legally, which Trump makes no hesitation, no secret of using as a partisan tool, or at least trying to, having his, Pete Hegseth firing senior military leaders on the basis of political dislike or even racial or gender dislike. Trump gives speeches to troops that are nakedly partisan, in which he insults Biden. He talks about using the military to go into the cities, the blue cities, as a training ground. This is maybe the most dangerous one. And I think the military is probably still the most inherently independent institution in the government, more than Congress, certainly more than apparently the Justice Department, because there is such a deep code of nonpartisanship, of independence, of not being political, and because it's so dangerous if the military does become a tool, a political tool of the president. But Trump would love for it to be that, and he's behaving as if he sees it that way.
Yeah. On the list of qualitative differences, the one that shocks me the most, or the the absence of widespread shock in response to it shocks me the most, which is this, the level of corruption that is so obvious with Trump and his enablers. I mean, I still remember a time when Hillary Clinton was castigated for her speaking fees when she was out of office, right? People just thought it was just totally unseemly that a former Secretary of State would dine out on her time in office to the tune of, you know, $200,000 or so to speak to hedge funds and, you know, Wall Street firms and other deep-pocketed hosts. And yet now we have Trump and his family literally raking in billions of dollars and creating mechanisms by which foreign agents and criminals can pay them directly, you know, in a meme coin, and even holding dinner for the people who have done that most lavishly to reward them with attention, and even using U.S. trade policy and even foreign policy to extort tribute from other countries. And yet somehow this isn't perceived to be the five-alarm fire that it is. I mean, somebody's worried about it. I'm worried about it. I know you're worried about it, but I think it's doing obvious damage to our reputation as a country. But just stepping back from the autopsy we've begun to perform here, I mean, how do you account for the fact that at least half of American society doesn't think that anything truly out of the ordinary is happening? How do you account for that perception? And leaving aside the people who simply don't follow the news or don't follow politics at all, or people who are so red-pilled or so deep in the MAGA cult that they just, you know, that up is down and down is up, and they simply don't care about the kinds of things we would list here as being crucial to the survival of our democracy. But I know ordinary people who read the Wall Street Journal and who are not MAGA, who don't share our concern about the fate of American democracy.
Yeah.
I would imagine you know a few of those people yourself too. How do you explain that state of mind?
That's a profound question that I've been asking myself all year and sort of waiting for the worm to turn and for suddenly there to be a kind of collective shock and awakening, and it doesn't happen. Perhaps it's because they wake up in the morning, the Wall Street Journal is still there. It's not been censored by the government. No one is knocking down their door in order to bring them in and question them about their political loyalties. They can take the commuter train or drive to work and listen to whatever they want, hundreds and hundreds of radio stations, podcasts, books, and then they get to work and people are doing the same thing they've always done. There's this sort of eerie normality to life, which I wrote about a bit in that piece. My life is also, even though I'm a journalist and this is what consumes me, when I look at the world around me, I just see the same world. You have to leap a bit into your imagination or into your ability to understand what's happening, maybe more abstractly. The Qatari jet made it very concrete, but meme coins and deals with UAE over AI chips that lead to all kinds of money flowing into the Trump family bank. These are pretty large, abstract scandals. There is no,
some of these
Monica,
same people would have reacted to, you know, the Hillary Clinton speaking fees or the Obamas getting a very rich Netflix deal, or, I mean, their sense of indiscretion was finally calibrated enough to react to those sorts of venial sins.
Yeah.
And yet when you have this black hole of corruption appear in the middle of our politics, sucking everything into it, they seem either not to care or they just think that basically everything is on par with everything else. There's no sense of magnitude. There's no scale that they're holding up to judge how colossal these changes are. It's analogous to saying, well, if you refer to Trump's, you know, 30,000 and counting documented lies, the response is, well, all politicians lie, right?
Yeah.
As though Trump were not lying on a scale we have never seen before.
Right. And your first example about Trump being prosecuted during the Biden years is, that's a grayer area, but it's another example of, well, who started it? There's always a way to say they do it too, or they did it first, and to sort of intellectually disarm and not bother with, let's look at this and really weigh it against what's happened before. There's always been political corruption. There's never been corruption like this. And in a way, I don't know, Sam, it may be that it's the blatancy of it. The openness is a bit of a shield for Trump. It's as if, well, of course he's corrupt. He's Trump. And he's not making any bones about it. He's doing it in daylight. He's not trying to hide anything. So that makes it seem, perhaps for some people, as if it's more acceptable than hypocrisy, which has a smell that people don't like.
I think you've put your finger on at least one variable here, which is that hypocrisy is the thing that people find most infuriating. And because Trump doesn't acknowledge the existence of any of these norms, the one thing you can't convict him of is hypocrisy. He really is not a hypocrite. He's just corrupt. He won't even acknowledge that corruption is a thing, right? Or self-dealing is a thing. This is, of course I'm self-dealing. This is, I would be stupid not to be self-dealing.
Right. And we all hate hypocrisy, and it seems slimy and, something sneaky about it. But when you're then confronted with blatant immorality and corruption, the virtue of hypocrisy begins to become clear. Mm. It is actually a sign that there are certain standards that have to be at least pretended to be kept. And if you don't, there's some shame involved, whereas there's no shame. And shamelessness with Trump is a great superpower. I'm beginning to think shamelessness might be the superpower of the most powerful and successful people in the world today. They all seem capable of doing anything, coming back from any embarrassment or scandal without being crippled by it. You could say, Elon Musk can be revealed to have cheated on every woman he's ever been with and had children across the landscape, et cetera. And it still doesn't matter because he's shameless and Trump is shameless. And so what is there more to say? Yeah, you're corrupt. I don't deny it.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a kind of superpower to feel that you never have to look back at the harms you cause, much less apologize for them. And I've noticed this whenever I've witnessed the aftermath of a public apology, how it so often leads to a kind of redoubling of the outrage over the thing apologized for. It rarely translates into just kind of relief. And I don't find this with personal apologies, but I just noticed that when challenged with the having to manage their reputation in public, when public figures apologize for something, it almost invokes more outrage. They become a kind of wounded prey animal, and the public just wants to see more blood at that point.
That is the nature, I think, of social media for sure, and of media generally. If you apologize, if the baying hounds finally force you into some public confession, it's going to look more like a Cultural Revolution confession, where that just becomes the trigger for them to then descend on you and tear you to pieces, rather than a ceremony of confession, atonement, redemption, forgiveness, which is what we would have in a more humane world. It just, in politics and in public life, it's a confession of weakness. And it seems as if the only real sin is weakness and shame and self-reproach. And there's so many politicians who apologized, didn't live to fight again. And the politicians who pretended it never happened or just ignored it, just hung on. We didn't like them, but they kept their power.
Yeah, you just recalled to mind Al Franken's exit from political life. What a quaint time that was.
he actually tried to say, I did something wrong and I'm sorry. I want to apologize to each of them individually. What a fool. Why not just say, so what? Make me resign.
Yeah. Okay, so looking forward, what bright lines do you see that if crossed, they would, those indiscretions would suffice to wake people up, or would just be whether the sleeping herd woke up, they would be especially worrying from your point of view that we had crossed further into, beyond the range of any democratic norms and physics?
I'm looking at next year's election and trying to think through all the ways in which it could be made less free and less fair. And there are a lot of them. There could be a kind of Bannon-esque flooding the zone with a lot of lies and accusations that just confuse people and make them think we can't possibly know what the real vote was, which was kind of the effect of the 2020 lies on a lot of people mm-hmm. who weren't ready to say it was stolen from Trump, but who just threw up their hands and kind of gave up trying to figure out the truth. Pressure on local and state officials, voter rolls being scoured, ICE being deployed to precincts around the election. And if it becomes a picture of someone being stopped from voting, if it has to be an image, then I think there could be a reaction, because the vote is a pretty primal right that Americans cherish. It's one that they don't seem willing to give up. If it's just too much confusion and too many different semi-facts colliding with each other, then it could happen that the election is not free and fair, and the public just doesn't see that and doesn't object to it because it's not clear. It's not, again, the Gestapo standing at polling places and carting off boxes of ballots. So that, for me, next year's election is the last barrier. Public opinion is the last barrier to the consolidation of an authoritarian regime. And that will be where we figure out whether we're going to give up the last of our democratic rights or not.
What about the Insurrection Act?
That could be a part of it, certainly. I mean, he's musing openly about it constantly. He's using this 18th century law, the Alien Enemies Act. So why not use a early 20th century law to deploy masked state police who are essentially, I mean, ICE has become more and more of a personal police force for the administration and for the president. They're recruiting, you know, in a way that suggests that these are people who are loyal to the president. That could be a big obstacle to having a free election. And the question really that you're asking is it enough if we see that masked ICE thugs getting in the way of voting lines, would that be enough? I have to think so. I have to think the vote is kind of the ultimate precious thing that people won't give up. But we've given up a lot in 10 short months without a real mass outcry. So I don't know who we are anymore. That's sort of what it comes down to. I'm not sure who we are. I'm not sure I have the faith that I used to.
Well, how much does hyperpartisanship play a role here and explain how disorienting the current political moment is and how there's so little kind of aptitude to recognize what we're losing? I mean, it seems to me that the far right and the far left, I mean, I guess this may have existed in some kind of inchoate form or less consequential form for as long as I've been alive, but at the moment, it's recognizable that the left is really no longer liberal, and the right is no longer conservative. They both have a kind of authoritarian character. And if you go far enough left or right, you find people who are united on a few points. I mean, these are people, especially when you're talking about the younger kind of Zoomer generation, people who just despise the establishment across the board. I mean, they just, this kind of the tear it all down brigade on both sides. There's no conception really of the common good. They just want to win, right? There's no concern about truth, whether it's scientific or journalistic or historical. I mean, with the possible exception of something like the Epstein files, you know, on the far right, they really are uncoupled from any kind of, you know, epistemology that wants to get at what's real. They simply just want to win. They want their tribe, however they conceive it, to win, and they don't even pay lip service to the kinds of democratic norms or, you know, American ideals that could give you a politics and an ethics that would apply to everyone in this country. And so that, I mean, I see that as, I mean, intuitively, I mean, there's some research to back this up, but intuitively, it seems like social media and the algorithmic derangement of everyone at every moment of the day and night is playing a role here. But I'm just wondering how you see the role that polarization is playing in the difficulty of even having a conversation like this matter to a sufficient number of people.
Yeah, I mean, it's an enormous problem. It's sort of the epistemological problem underneath the political problem. We can't solve things. Congress can't act on behalf of the country. The government can't solve big problems because the goal is power. The end is power, not the means. The end is power. And power means ignoring or denying truth, because truth is inconvenient for power. It's constantly undermining it. And the problem for liberals, which I count myself as one, and I imagine you do too, is that we, and by liberals I mean people who believe in objective truth and in pluralism and due process and freedom of speech.
Yeah.
We are in this defensive position all the time now, where we're trying to protect these incredibly important values that came out of the Enlightenment. And meanwhile, younger people on both the right and the left find it negligible or even risible to talk about norms and procedures because the world is terrible. So, and there's injustice everywhere, and the other side wants to destroy the country. And so we are in a position of a defensive crouch when we also have to do something else, which is to try to figure out how to reform our political system so that it is responsive to legitimate alienation and disaffection, because it, some of it is legitimate, and then some of it is amplified by the algorithms of social media into insanity. But it may begin with a little kernel of truth, and if we can't see it and speak to it, then we too are falling into that same vortex where we just cannot communicate with each other. We have no common language, because the common language we need now is a language that can also reach young people. I don't have it. I'm well aware that I'm a creature of an earlier time, of an earlier generation, and the world that we're in now is not a world I ever imagined. I didn't think the world I grew up in California, was going to disappear, but that's what's happened in the last maybe decade or two. And I honestly don't feel well equipped to do anything other than defend what I think is a value.
Well, as proof of our irrelevance, you and I just started this conversation by singing the praises of hardcover books. So,
but there are some retro moments. There are young people turning to light phones and vinyl records and maybe hardcover books.
Right. Yeah, vinyl records. I've seen the young embrace that anachronism. What do you think about the schism that has been emerging on the right around just how fully to embrace white nationalism and anti-Semitism without apology? Yeah. We have somewhat paradoxical figure of Nick Fuentes being mainstreamed by the deeply weird character of Tucker Carlson. Perhaps you can explain his career as a journalist to me. I've heard rumors that he was once a fine writer, and now he's a talented demagogue and fabulist and weirdo, and I'm not quite sure what accounts for that transformation. But
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah.
I met him once for about 5 seconds at a White House correspondence affair, and he said, "Oh, George Packer, you don't promote yourself enough." And I got a little hint of what matters to Tucker Carlson.
Right. Well, so, and Fuentes is also, this is kind of a weird cultural moment because of how a young man with the last name Fuentes has become the apotheosis of white nationalism in America is somewhat inscrutable to me. But nevertheless, he seems to be. And the right is showing that it has some antibodies to this, but not perhaps not a sufficient number. I think, J.D. Vance is kind of splitting the difference here, and he's not doing much to alienate Fuentes' cult of so-called Groypers. How do you view just the forward-looking condition of, right of center in our politics?
I think this is the fruit of a devil's bargain that they made. When Trump was elected and then especially reelected, the Republican Party, whatever elements of it, were kind of holdouts and had their doubts about him, but wanted to stay in power, gave up. So they gave Trump their full loyalty. It's become a cult. It's not a political party. And therefore, what Trump brings in, they accept because they don't want to run afoul of the cult leader. And Trump seems to have no limit to his appetite for interest in white nationalists, bigots of various types, transgressors. He doesn't even seem to be drawing the line at anti-Semitism, which you would think he would do because of his daughter and son-in-law, because of his upbringing in New York City. And J.D. Vance has a lot to answer for. He has a long record of saying hostile things about Trump. And when he decided to make his bed with Trump, he had to atone for all of that. And I think he still is doing that by not objecting to young Republicans talking about loving Hitler, by Tucker Carlson flirting with a neo-Nazi, and even Vance accepts when these white nationalists insult his own wife.
Yeah.
So once you've made it into a cult that tolerates or has a kind of flirtation with hatred, it's very hard to draw a line. And instead, it keeps eroding. The line just keeps eroding to the right. There are no enemies to the right. And so bring in Nick Fuentes, bring in Tucker Carlson. And I think that's a great mistake, both morally and politically. But it's sort of the bed they've made. And now we're watching it. It's disturbing to some people on the right. Rod Dreher has become a big critic of this, even though he's very close friends with J.D. Vance. I think he's kind of, he wrote a long piece on Substack suggesting that he had gone to see Vance at the White House and had a few minutes with him. He didn't repeat what they said, but you can imagine him saying, you know, please be careful, J.D. I'm worried about the direction things are going in. And Vance has not said anything publicly to suggest that he's taken in that message.
Yeah, I mean, I read Dreher's piece, and he was quite alarmed and horrified to discover that, you know, on someone's account, something like 30 to 40% of young Republicans in government and the activists are, if not, you know, fully paid up Groypers fans of Nick Fuentes. And that's just when you look at the kinds of things Fuentes has said. You know, he's a fan of Hitler. He's a fan of Joseph Stalin. He's utterly obsessed with Jewish conspiracy theories.
And do you find yourself wondering if he really believes it, or if this is just transgression to be bad?
Yeah,
it seems a bit that way to me.
I mean, the problem I perceive with, there are several problems with people like Tucker and Fuentes. I mean, one we just have the problem of the charismatic psychopath. You know, these people are entertaining. They're very good at what they do. They're very good on the microphone. They're very good on television. They can apparently be quite sincere and even self-effacing in a very canny and manipulative way. I mean, Tucker is especially good at this. Tucker will say, listen, I get all kinds of things wrong. I'm, you know, I'm the biggest sinner and I've got a lot to atone for. And then he'll go on to just unveil, you know, endless half-truths and lies and, you know, poison the discourse in front of the largest possible audience in the aftermath of having expressed that kind of humility. But there are a few other problems. One is that, you know, half-truths or even inconvenient truths that right-thinking people won't touch are even more important than lies in some respects, right? So all these guys, you know, Tucker and Fuentes, among them, can point to the thing that the so-called liberal elites won't touch, and that is their smoking gun. And it really is a profound weakness that so many of these things are outside the Overton window for the, you know, mainstream journalists and academics. And they do this around Israel. They do this around, you know, race issues, you know, crime in the Black community, right? You know, crime in Chicago. Why can't we talk about that? And it is profoundly effective in the face of left of center diversion and elision and lack of candor. You can spin up kind of an endlessly sinister conspiracy theories on the basis of facts that are, in fact, real. It's too simple to say that it's all lies, right? I mean, that's the problem. If it was all just lies, it'd be much easier to deal with. It's also the fact that left of center, we have had a, what wokeness, for lack of a better word, has done. You know, we're still, the bell has kind of been unrung, I think, over there, but we're still living with the aftermath of what this did to our political discourse, left of center, and it's been a disaster. I mean, it was a tsunami of confirmation bias and double standards and half-truths that we lived with for at least, you know, 4, 5, 6 years.
Or more. Yeah, I completely agree. And part of the, you said discourse, and I think that's an important word, because part of this self-binding, self-gagging that you're talking about, it has to do with certain issues, certain social problems that can't be discussed honestly. And it also has to do with language. the language with which you discuss problems. And if you look at the language of the left, which you can sort of see almost cataloged in what are called equity language guides, which have been, I wrote about this a couple of years ago in The Atlantic. These are distributed around nonprofits and activist organizations. Every banned word, and there are a lot of insane examples of a banned word.
I remember blacklist. Stanford produced its list of verboten terms at one point. I remember blacklist was on it.
Yep. Brown bag.
Yeah.
Blind. Stand. Because not everyone can stand up.
Right.
It's an inequitable word because some people are unable to stand. So the Sierra Club had one, and I just went through it and just thought it will be impossible to speak unless you master an arcane substitute discourse that's basically a lot of polysyllabic euphemisms that make it harder and harder to know what you're talking about. It's as if the purpose of this language is to conceal reality because some things are painful to talk about. So you can't say criminal, you have to say justice involved person because criminal has a pejorative sound to it. But once you've said justice involved person, you've sort of made prison go away, or at least make it less of a terrible thing to befall you. Crime suddenly is no longer crime. And whereas the right has the advantage of using brutal, blunt, mocking terms that most of which I wouldn't want to use because they're deeply disrespectful. They're bigoted. But to be able to use that language, Trump makes use of this too. It sounds as if you're the only one willing to tell the truth, and the other side can't face the truth, and they hide behind marginalization and terms that add syllable upon syllable until the thing you're talking about disappears.
Yeah. I should say this is something you expose in, again, in kind of parable form in your novel, which is very effective on this front. I mean, you talk about, or you depict the kind of cultural revolution of some version of wokeness happening among the young in early in your novel. And it's all very chilling and well executed. What about the Jeffrey Epstein story, now that we're back to that? The one thing that MAGA up until this moment seems to have cared about heart and soul, judging from my algorithmic news diet, they seem to be losing their nerve a little. Maybe they're going to come back around and double down and triple down and defy their cult leader's efforts to suppress the story. But is this going to be the thing that reveals that Teflon only runs so deep in Trumpistan?
Or that there's a limit to shamelessness?
Yeah.
That shame actually exists way out at the outer limits of shamelessness, and that its name is Jeffrey Epstein and pedophilia. It's interesting, isn't it? I don't know about you. I have always been really skeptical of the whole notion of an Epstein conspiracy, that there's this document somewhere that has the names of every important person in the country and some from other countries who got a massage from an underage girl at an Epstein island. But Trump is sure acting as if there is something there, at least where he's concerned. And the more we learn from these emails, the more famous people's names come up. Lawrence Summers' name seems to be in a lot of the emails that were just released by congressional Republicans. So it's like someone said, even paranoids have enemies, and even some conspiracy theories are true. And I don't know what's there, but what's interesting is it does seem to be the sticking point for MAGA. Like, this is the one thing that Trump can't seem to get rid of. He could, as he said, shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and he'd be fine.
Yeah.
But if his name is in the Epstein files, watch out.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we will get a chance to see it play out. I mean, I like you, I haven't had much time for a conspiracy around this. I mean, I think the truth about it is probably self-evident that, you know, Epstein was a super creep, and Trump is also a super creep, although whether he had a taste for illegally underage girls remains to be seen. But it's just, maybe there's something there that, short of there being a real conspiracy where Epstein is proven to be some kind of intelligence asset who's really, you know, blackmailing high-profile people and all the rest, Trump may just appear culpable enough for having known and remained friends with Epstein for so long that his what is being leaked may just in fact prove that Trump knew and simply didn't care that Epstein was trafficking in underage victims of his sex crimes, right? It was just that part will become undeniable, and Trump is implicated just by association, whether or not he actually participated in anything.
Right. It's as if the combination of elites and pedophilia is such a perfect expression of the thinking of populism, because this the worst offense, the kind that gets you killed in prison, and the worst people, the elites,
right,
the financiers, the politicians, the
when
royal
you
family.
Add the adrenochrome to it, then that you know the intimations of cannibalism. That's when it becomes stratospheric, and it's
just too tempting, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm hoping for the email from Trump's office, which says something like, "Jeffrey, you know, just how much of this adrenochrome do I have to take? Or is it okay to put it in a glass of milk?" What do you think about the post-Trump landscape politically for Republicans? Is there a way that a recognizably normal Republican Party is born in the aftermath of Trump? What would a J.D. Vance candidacy or presidency look like? Just how cynical and scary a character is he, in your view?
I think they've just unleashed too many demons to ever go back to Mitt Romney or George W. Bush. I think the party will be a generation or more reckoning, wrestling with the ugliness that it's embraced. But it will be chaotic, I think. It will not have a cult leader to hold it in line. And all the cleavages that we're sort of now beginning to see are embodied in J.D. Vance. He's a working-class boy who became a member of the elite meritocracy, and then of Silicon Valley, sort of the dark clique around Peter Thiel, and he remains an advocate for deregulation or no regulation for AI and cryptocurrency. But he also has seen populism as his way, you know, into Trump's favor and into the highest or second highest office. How's he going to reconcile that? He once gave a speech earlier this year saying, I'm a proud member of both tribes, the techno-futurists and the populists. I don't think you can be. I think those two are just utterly at odds. And that will be one of the fault lines that we will see start to break the party apart. It's just not a stable thing to have a political party become a cult. It can't return. You can't just suddenly start being sane and healthy again. Instead, there'll be all kinds of morbid after effects. With Trump, if he's still alive, we don't know how long this guy has. He looks quite old and tired this week. He's having a bad week, which made me wonder as I came here, Sam, we're going to talk about authoritarianism, but he sure seems to be a feckless president right now. And it made me think, how do we have a combination of a leader who has knocked down all these ancient checks on presidential power and also cannot possibly control the news cycle for 12 hours because he keeps doing stupid things like knocking down the East Wing and dining with the heads of all the big banks while people are losing their food stamps. So it's a bit of a mixed picture there. And I think the Republican Party is going to find that it has fractured itself. It's sort of sown the seeds of a lot of disorder once Trump starts to lose that powerful grip he's had on the party for 10 years almost.
Yeah, so I'm really of two minds about the role that wealth inequality is playing and can play in our current moment. I mean, on some level, I worry that an economic downturn could unleash a level of unhappiness on both the left and the right that would be fairly destabilizing in the current environment. But I also, part of me expects the silver lining there to be that an economic downturn is the only thing that could convince a majority of people who have not been convinced by any of the things we have described thus far that Trump has brought us toward the brink in some sense. I mean, if the stock market went down by 30 or 40%, revealing an AI bubble or some other cause, I think the tariff policy and having people in charge who were picked for their loyalty above all rather than their competence, all of that would be seen in a new light by tens of millions of more people. It would be a stiff price to pay for the, that epiphany. But I just think losing money is the only thing that's going to convince some people that anything truly negative is happening in our society.
I think you're right, but I've begun to lose faith in even that fundamental reality, shaking people's partisan loyalties loose. I mean, there's been polling showing that when there's a bad economy under one's own president, his followers think it's a good economy and vice versa. And so Republicans right now are not nearly as sour on cost of living, unemployment, and economic growth as Democrats are. But do you think that's that we're still living in that Newtonian world where an economic downturn, a recession, even stock market crash changes people's fundamental political affiliations?
There are certain lines that are still bright that when you cross them, you really can't tell yourself a story that you that what just happened didn't really happen, right? So if the stock market goes down 30% very quickly and stays down for a good long while, and people start losing jobs, and you know, or in success, if AI, you know, as it seems to be already beginning to happen, if AI starts to prove that it really has a net job canceling function, and we start seeing unemployment soar, I just think that, I know people have said this about the price of eggs too, but like that will be undeniable on some level. I mean, it's like you can't really. Partisan bias can only hide so much pain.
Yeah, I just heard Vance on Fox News saying grocery costs are down, energy costs are down, things are moving in the right direction. And I know that that's not true. Right. And in fact, electricity bills are way up. So then it seems as if he becomes yet another out-of-touch politician, even though he's from Southwest Ohio and grew up in hard conditions. He's another out-of-touch politician who has no idea how people are living. And if they know that the price of gas remains what it was last year and that the price of electricity has gone up, it's a vulnerability on him.
Well, people of a certain age remember that moment where Baghdad Bob was giving us his spiel and American tanks were passing by in the shot over his shoulders. How do you view the role that economic pain and inequality plays in explaining the moment we're in? I mean, do you view the pressure on either or both sides from the economy and from just the Gen Z loss of optimism? It's been widely reported that this is the first generation that really can't rationally expect to have a standard of living as good as the one enjoyed by their parents.
Right, and if they live in the city, they vote for Zoran Mamdani.
Yeah.
And if they live in the heartland, in a small town or in a rural area, they vote for Donald Trump or someone on the far right.
Right.
I used to think, to answer your question, almost entirely in those terms, that deindustrialization, the wiping out of a whole way of living and of working in huge parts of the country without the elites noticing really or doing much about it except to say, we'll retrain you for a computer job, and the slow erosion of towns and states, the seemingly rigged solution to the financial crisis, which bailed out the banks and left everyone else holding the bank. All of that, I wrote a book called The Unwinding that was kind of a narrative based on that assumption that that was what was driving people to political extremes. But then we've had these technological changes, and I just don't think you can underestimate what social media and just the alienation that comes from being in front of a screen all the time and the algorithms that control your thinking, what that has done, maybe it was primed by old-fashioned material conditions where people saw their status and their wealth declining, not into absolute poverty, but just into relative low status.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was, I think it was made toxic, poisonous by social media so that it could no longer be reached through politics, through policies, so that Joe Biden has these big bills that are all about bringing old-fashioned manufacturing jobs to red states, He was quite deliberate in targeting them. It made absolutely no difference. Now, perhaps they hadn't had time to really take effect, but really what mattered was that it was a Democrat who was doing it. And by then, those people were Republicans and they were not Sherrod Brown wasn't even enough of a populist to win a re-election. So I think we're in deeper trouble than we were in 1932, because in 1932, an inspiring political figure without a very clear economic agenda, but just promising help, could change American politics for 50 years. And today, I don't know that it happens that way, because of the way in which partisanship and media have divided us into separate worlds, separate realities.
Yeah, and also AI is fast changing things. I mean, the one thing you can't say today, in whatever spirit of callousness or compassion, you cannot say learn to code. That's the one admonishment that is a dead end career-wise now.
What's Silicon Valley going to say now? How are they going to keep people on board with AI?
So you said the word status, which is, I don't think we, on some level, we talk about it implicitly all the time, but we rarely explicitly reference it and contemplate the mad work it does psychologically and socially. How do you think about status and the kind of the shifting parameters of it culturally? I mean, obviously, the one way to explain Trump's power and popularity has been that he is, on some level, he's low status. I mean, he can credibly say that he's not an elite, even though he's, you know, pretended to be a billionaire for long enough to actually become a billionaire. There's something, you know, his WWE crassness, and I mean, he really has it both ways. He can brag about being a genius who went to Wharton, and yet also credibly evince his hatred of the so-called elites and share the so-called low status contempt for elite institutions that his base relishes in. You know, I'll just tee that up for you in whatever way. How do you think about status in our politics and in our culture at this moment?
I think at this moment and always, it's really fundamental for Americans. We tolerate a lot more economic inequality than our counterparts in Europe, where if you're Swedish, you don't really want people to know how much money you have, and you're willing to pay pretty high taxes, at least in the old days before populism came to Sweden, to make sure that the working class isn't sinking to a point where there's going to be social unrest. Whereas Americans, I think we tolerate it because we have the sense that, well, that way is open to everyone. We can all get rich because we have this capitalist system and a culture of social equality where it doesn't matter where you're from. It doesn't matter who your parents were. It doesn't even matter, and this, of course, is no longer true, but it shouldn't matter where you went to school as long as your talents take you. So we sort of see economic inequality as a legitimate expression of differences in how hard people work and how talented they are. That's fading because more and more people think of the meritocracy as being an unfair system, even a rigged system. But social status is really crucial because, as Tocqueville said, you know, the most striking thing about America when in the 1830s was the equality of conditions. And by that, he meant there is a level of social evenness so that everyone essentially has the same status. It doesn't mean they have the same wealth, but they have the same status. Of course, that wasn't remotely true for a lot of Americans who were enslaved or were women or were Native Americans. But that was the passion, was to say, I am as good as anyone. And once you feel there's an elite class that is hoarding its privileges and looks down on you as lower status because of lack of education, the way you talk, where you live, what kind of job you do, I think that's the unforgivable thing for Americans and the thing that Trump has been exploiting for a long time now, the sense that they look down on you. And Tocqueville also said Americans would be willing to give up their liberty in exchange for equality, which is not something you would imagine about America until you think, yeah, that's what Trump is sort of offering. I will take your liberty from you. I'll do it all. I'm going to be the king. And in return, I am going to lower those people down so that they can no longer look down on you and make you feel that you don't count and that you've been disrespected. And that's a deal that his followers seem to have been willing to make. So that's why I used the word status earlier, because I think it can't be underestimated as a driving force, a source of grievance more than the fact that we have billionaires and homeless people.
Yeah. That's why I think the wokeness and its attendant sanctimony was so disastrous on the left. I mean, it really became a kind of political superstimulus where, I mean, nothing was more infuriating than that. The shrinkage of the Overton window, the various, fake shibboleths that would get someone reputationally murdered if they didn't adhere to them scrupulously. I mean, just there's things that I was just recently reminded of, one that I had forgotten or repressed in my memory, but there was a moment, I think this was during COVID, where someone got defenestrated for having some hand gesture that looked like a white power symbol, you know, some random electrician in his truck.
Truck in LA, right? Like a working class dude in LA. Exactly.
Yeah, he just, like, his hand was hanging out of his, pickup truck window, and someone caught him, with their cell phone, and this led to his firing. That stuff was coming down in torrents upon us and on social media, and right of center, or even just in the center, it radicalized everyone. I mean, it was just so crazy making.
Yeah. I mean, I was one of the writers of the so-called Harper's Letter, which was a very basic statement of support for freedom of expression, signed by a lot of interesting people from every political persuasion. And it immediately became the notorious Harper's Letter because—
And it's a totally anodyne statement of free speech.
It was pathetically anodyne, but we had to write it that way in order to get 150 people from Margaret Atwood to David Frum and Noam Chomsky and Wynton Marsalis to sign it. It had to be something everyone could agree on. And it turned out, those 150 and maybe some people who felt oppressed by this code of censoriousness, but so many people, especially in the media, just couldn't bear it. It was considered an affront to everything good and decent. Even to this day, if you mention Harper's Letter in certain circles, you're going to get people rolling their eyes.
Well, on that point, and perhaps this will be my final question, do you think that the Democrats have learned this lesson? And what are you expecting in the candidacies of those put forward for, let's forecast all the way to 2028? Are we going to see a Mamdani-like capture of the Democratic Party into social justice hysteria and moral panic yet again? Or are we going to have a sane, pragmatic, centrist, grown-up represent the Democrats against whoever MAGA throws up?
Well, Mamdani himself seems to have learned something because his entire campaign was about affordability. He didn't want to be asked about Israel. He didn't want to be asked about identity politics, about religion, about race. None of that was on his famous TikTok videos and his speeches and his debate. He was focused on the fact that people in New York were having a very hard time making it and living decently. That tells me that something, at least when it came to a campaign, was learned. But I worry that identity politics is just so deeply ingrained in the thinking of political professionals on the left, activists, elected officials, a lot of media people who are deep blue, that it's going to keep coming back in some form because it's been with us for a long time, and a whole generation just came of age with it in the last 10 years, starting maybe in 2014. It was the template for understanding the world, oppressor groups, oppressed groups. It's very difficult to then erase the formation of your thinking about politics in time for an election. So I think there'll be attempts to find unifying themes and to downplay the issues that are 80-20 issues, where almost the overwhelming majority of Americans are against you. But the thinking, the underlying thinking, I think it'll be there, just as the virus of MAGA is going to continue to make the Republican Party crazy for quite a while after Trump has gone from the scene.
Well, it will not be boring. There's a silver lining. There'll be something to talk about.
We'll have a lot to talk about.
Well, George, thank you for your time and thank you for your work. I'm a great fan, and I recommend that people get your new book, The Emergency, and also read you in The Atlantic, where you make sense at regular intervals.
Thank you for having me, and I hope you can get through the rest of it and enjoy it, and it doesn't keep you up at night.
That was a lot of fun.
Great.
Well, until next time, George.
Thanks a lot, Sam.